Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and today we're revisiting a story by Ed Gee that he told on Risk back in 2015, plus a conversation that he had with his good friend Ophira Eisenberg a whole decade later now. Both are brilliant storytellers and longtime friends of the show, and we're just so honored that they recorded this thoughtful and heartfelt conversation for us. Now, this story concerns child sexual abuse. Other than that, after a quick break, we'll revisit Quid Pro Quo with Ed Gee and Ophira Eisenberg.
Hello, it's Zed Gavigan. I have been listening to Kevin Allison for more than 10 years live, and I would go to those shows in basements and small theaters. And one day I decided to get up and tell a story according to the theme of Risk, a thing that I had not talked about. And this was in 2015, gosh, more than 10 years ago. And it was a very difficult story to tell. I hadn't done a lot of preparation. And so listening to that today, I wanted to have my dear friend Ophira, storytelling compatriot. We've told stories all across America together for, I would say, 10 years now. And we commiserate on marriage and parenting and storytelling. And
we've
trauma, and also trauma. Don't forget the trauma. That's the original bond.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, my pleasure. And, you know, the one thing, as we'll hear as soon as we roll the story, is that every one of Ed's stories, obviously, they are incredibly well crafted because he's a great storyteller, as you will hear. But also, especially with this one, the topics that you decide to tackle from your life are difficult, ones that people don't necessarily bring to light. And also, I think ultimately when you tell these stories, people come up to you afterwards and they divulge a lot about themselves.
They do.
Because they feel like they finally heard someone talk to them about something that they've been holding on to.
Yeah, and I hadn't understood that. This story was probably the fourth or fifth time I'd ever been up on stage. Like, I had started telling stories with The Moth, I think 2009, and I told a couple of stories, and then I decided to do the Risk story. But having people come up afterwards is a really potent side effect that I never understood.
I know.
And you must have that as well.
Yeah, and the things that they point out are the things that you maybe even glossed over while you're crafting the story, because, you know, when we're making these things fit for, listen, entertainment, ultimately, we look at them a little bit differently. So,
and they kind of want to tell you their whole story.
Yes.
And people will stand behind the person telling me their story, waiting to tell me their story.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, okay, I just finished. I thank you. And I feel for you. And can you just email me?
Could I? I just want a tequila.
I want a tequila.
Sit in a dark corner.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know sometimes I've had that experience myself after stories, and I've thought, God, maybe I need to get a social work degree to tell these stories.
But then you realize how important it is.
Yeah.
You know, people hear that someone else, and a lot of times it's bound up with shame, you know, where they're like, oh my gosh, this person just got up and said the thing that I've been hiding.
Removed it. And in 2015, we certainly didn't run around and talk about being seen and heard. That is a very new way of expressing that. But
yeah,
that is the perfect words, I think, of what happens when you tell a story that people have some inroads into personally, and you allow the vulnerability that makes them, by listening, feel seen and heard.
Yeah. Well, and you feel like, oh, that thing that felt so particular to me is actually much more common.
Yeah, much more universal.
Should we listen to Quid Pro Quo?
I'd love to. Let's do it.
All right. Here we go.
My family ended up in Wyoming when I was about 12 years old because my dad was in the military. Most people think of Wyoming in terms of nature and wildlife and Yellowstone. But I think if Wyoming seceded from the United States, it'd be like the sixth largest nuclear power in the world. So there's all these nuclear missiles out there. My dad was in the military, so he guarded the nuclear missile bases. He started out as a drill sergeant, but then he was court-martialed for brutality. Now, if you can imagine how brutal you have to be as a drill sergeant in 1968 sending men to Vietnam to be court-martialed, that's my dad. So he ended up military police, which says all you need to know about that trajectory. But he was my dad. And so I had a high and tight crew cut every 2 weeks until we got to Wyoming. The long fuse that was my parents' marriage finally detonated when we were there, which was as far away from any family members or friends or anyone we knew. And my dad was just the kind of guy that could punch a pregnant wife and have no problems with it. And like there were days I couldn't go to school because my mom would keep me home till the black eyes were gone. And it was just terrible. Like, he would be beating my mother, and I would jump on his back at 10 to try and stop him. And then he'd throw me and keep going with her. At the end of the whole thing, he ends up leaving one night in a huff and cleaned out all the bank accounts and disappeared with the car the next day. So he left my mother with no job, no car, empty bank accounts, and four kids in Cheyenne, Wyoming. The last thing that we did as a family, it's funny, I'll never forget this, was the Freedom Train was coming through Cheyenne to celebrate the bicentennial. And that was kind of like the last thing we ever did was go and see the exhibits of our country. And then he was gone. And life was fucking hard, and we had no clue how to do anything. And it was so bad. It was like, how can I be wishing for that fucker to be back here? Because that was better. So we went to the Catholic school, which was in Cheyenne, a few blocks away from us, and they gave my mom a job as a secretary down there. And we got free lunch at the school, and we just, you know, tried to do the best we could. We got food stamps, and, you know, I became the man of the house. Like, I would go out and rake leaves and mow lawns and shovel snow, and we had these envelopes. I put my money in the house payment envelope first. That was the one we'd have to fill up. We'd sit at the kitchen table. My mom was just, you know, just a wreck, like, And I'm trying to be like, no, it's okay, Mom. I'll mow some more lawns or shovel some more snow. I would be an altar boy down at the church. And if you did funerals, the families of the deceased would tip you. So I would always try and volunteer for all the funeral gigs that I could get as an altar boy. Then we got this new bishop. It was a big deal because the old bishop had been like this 80-year-old guy who never got out and never did anything. And was just kind of like this old, dusty dude that nobody really knew about. And this new bishop was like in his late 50s, kind of a energetic guy. And I met him during one of my altar boy gigs. And he said, would you be able to come and rake leaves at the bishop's house for me? And I was, yeah, fine. So I mean, the bishop's mansion, it was like, it had columns in front, and it had a big wrought iron fence around it, and shrubs and everything. So I started doing, you know, mow the lawn, and rake the leaves, and shovel the snow. Then at Thanksgiving time, a couple priests pulled up from the church, like the day before Thanksgiving, and they get out, and they have these cardboard boxes, and we had brought food, cans of corn my mom had given each one of us to bring to school for the poor people, the food drive that they have at the school. And so the priests pulled up and get out, and they give us a turkey and these cans of food. And My mom said it was because she worked at the church and these were things that they had left over. And it made sense. So it was just like, okay, it wasn't like we were getting our cans of corn back, you know? And so we have a good Thanksgiving dinner. And then I'm going to shovel snow at the Bishop's. And it was a Saturday, you know, it's Wyoming, so it fucking snowed every week. And I would be over there and I'd shovel the snow. And then this day, I mean, the Bishop's house was like incredible. He had this cooler in the garage that was just filled with every kind of soda you could imagine. He had root beer and Country Time lemonade and Shasta, every flavor, and blackberry soda if you wanted. And we didn't have any of that at our house. And he also did a lot of entertaining. So there was like honey roasted cashews and shit, like just boxes of it and pretzels and all this stuff. And he would say to me, after you're done whatever the chore is, you know, let's go in the garage. We'll have a soda. You can drink, have all you want, you know, and have all the snacks you want. Look, we got plenty, you know, and you're doing a good job. So don't worry about it. And I'd be there and I'd be drinking these sodas. And I was just like, wow, this is treats I don't get. And so then this particular Saturday, you know, it was right after Thanksgiving. And he says to me, you know, you come up to my bedroom. And I go up there and he's sitting on the bed. He's got like a half full rocks glass with whiskey in it and a cigarette. And he's like, I don't tell anybody I smoke, you know. And he's like, he pulls me up next to him and he goes, now it's time for confession. Now, I knew all about confession because I really didn't like to go, but it was something that you did in church, in the screen, in a booth. You know, you kind of knew which guy was in which booth, so you could pick, you know, according to who was more lenient for whichever sin you were doing. But, you know, you never actually had to see the guy face to face. And so he goes, now, you know, it's time for confession. And I was like, well, this doesn't seem like anything I've ever done before. So I kind of trot out my laundry list. You know, I was rude to my mother and I punched my brother and, you know, didn't let my sister join in or, you know, whatever my little shitty 12-year-old list of sins was. And then he's like, no, this isn't going to work if you don't, like, get to the real sins. And I was like, well, I don't know what you mean. And he goes, what about the impure thoughts? And I was like, impure thoughts? No, I'm drawing a blank here, dude. I was 12. Like, for me, puberty was like 5 years away. Like, I was a small, pale, hairless kid in the gym. Like, everybody else was sprouting hair and muscles and deepening voices and getting taller. And I was just like this little dude, like, scared of everything. I would never take a shower. And so I didn't have impure thoughts. I didn't know what masturbation was. I'd never seen pornography. It was just all still to be discovered. And I definitely didn't have any impure thoughts. That's very frustrating for him because he says, you know, you're not going to get a full confession if you don't confess all your sins. And I just kept drawing a blank. So he goes, listen, pull down your pants. You're going to have to show me what you do when you think about girls. And I was like, I didn't cry, but I got like kind of choked up. And I was like, this is so fucking weird, man. I don't know what's the next thing I'm supposed to do? Because you're asking me about stuff I don't know about. So he pulls my pants down. And at this point, it's like this, we're having this like thing where we're sparring kind of. And then he goes, you know what? The church has been really good to your family. And it would just be a shame if all of that came to an end because you cannot confess your sins. And I looked at him and I'm like, well, I'm just trying to, you know, what is it that, you know, I should be saying or doing? And he's like, you know, the church needs you to confess. And I'm the bishop. And this is how you just need to do what I'm asking you to do, or you're not going to be able to be forgiven. And it would just be terrible for your sins to like make your family suffer. And at that moment, there was this kind of calculus that took place. I got to provide for my family. And there's a certain, like, you know, I'm just going to, he's the boss. That's it, I guess. I'm just going to go along with this. And so then I did. A few weeks later, it's Christmas, and we're at the midnight mass, and I'm, you know, an altar boy there. There's incense. They're singing all these songs in Latin. It's kind of incomprehensible. Then he gets up and starts to talk, and I'm just thinking to myself, dads aren't supposed to leave. Maybe if I'd been a better kid, he wouldn't have left. And then I don't think that guy's supposed to be doing that to me, but, you know, he said that stuff about God sending his son. And I look up, and there's a crucifix with some kind of malignant dead guy on it. And I'm just thinking, the fucking adults, man, I have no fucking clue. How the fuck does all of this shit make sense? Like, there's no rhyme or reason to how these people who are supposed to be in charge just doesn't make sense to me. And I'm listening to him talk, and I'm looking up at the crucifix, and I'm looking out at the people, I'm smelling the incense and poinsettias everywhere. And I'm just like, all right, like, just try and do what they say and just get them off your back. Don't make any waves. So for the next year, I would try and, like, think to myself, you know, at the beginning, I would go over when it snowed and shovel the sidewalk, and I wouldn't go, and he'd call, and where's Ed? And my mom would be like, you got to go. You know, it's the bishop calling. You have to go. It was just like hopeless. So it was just like, okay, I got to, you know, I have to provide for my family. We can't take any more setbacks. And then the next year I asked if I could not be an altar boy anymore, and I could not go to the Catholic school. I wanted to go to the public school and just kind of quit going to church. You know, kind of made my way, and I didn't really have anything to do with him. Yeah, I'm sure, you know, he found other outlets. You know, I had, like, kind of authority issues. I had a lot of problems in terms of rebellion. But when I was a senior in high school, I really wanted to go to Notre Dame. And there was no fucking way on earth this, like, nobody kid, nobody in my family had ever been to college, was going to get to go to Notre Dame. So I sent a letter to the bishop, and so he wrote me a letter, and I got in. And, you know, I had good SATs and all that, but I'm sure it was a letter from the Bishop of Wyoming that pushed the right buttons. And as I grew up and went to school and all that, I didn't really hate the guy. Like, at the end of the day, you're going to have, you know, pedophile clergy. You're going to have crooked cops. You're going to have bad doctors. It's people, right? People in the world, people in jobs. But it's the institution that should have done the right thing. And it turns out the reason we got this young bishop come to Wyoming was that he'd been transferred from Kansas City, where they had caught him, because one of the kids that he'd been molesting killed himself. And so then, to cover it up, they sent him to the middle of nowhere, to where I lived. Anyway, I got my education. I studied architecture and philosophy. Got to go to school in Rome for a year. I learned to speak Italian. I learned a lot about the history of the Catholic Church. I learned a lot about Latin. Latin phrases are important in philosophy and architecture. And I guess the phrase that I feel like I learned very early on was quid pro quo. Thanks.
Let's take a big sigh.
Hard to hear. Yeah.
Yeah, of course it's hard to hear. You're 10 years after hearing that. I got to say, just you for the fourth time as a performer getting on stage and telling that story, when listening to that, can you be back on that stage?
I am. Yeah. And I remember feeling lost, like thinking to myself, I'm going to burst into tears. Yeah. What am I going to tell right now that I can wrap my head around that will kind of divert my emotion. And as I listen to it now, I can hear myself kind of trying to calibrate my storytelling to kind of tamp down the emotion.
The emotions. You know? Otherwise, you're just basically bawling on stage.
Otherwise, you just go, I'm going to sit here and cry for a minute. And as you tell it, I think, to do it successfully, you have to relive it.
I know. Back this is one of the things I love and hate the most.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. And so there were things like, it was hard for me to hear, even just right now, like the food drive, bringing the cans of corn to school for the poor people. And then on Thanksgiving, they pull up with the food for us. And my mom's like, oh, this was just extra stuff they had left over. And I believed it, you know, and now I look back on that and I'm just like, oh man, you know, we were getting our canned goods back.
Right.
And it's hard to realize that, I mean, we were so poor, you know, in terms of the deprivation Olympics, you know, you talk to people these days and they'll be like, man, we had no money growing up. And then they'll tell some story and I'll be like, wait a second, you had two parents. And
I mean, like, listen, there's all kinds of stuff like that. I, you know, New York is an interesting place to live because there's so many rich people. Mm-hmm. And then there's people that, you know, have come from all kinds of backgrounds. But sometimes you talk to someone and they're like, we were so poor growing up. We had only two cars or whatever. And you're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Very different worlds.
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you about this so much more, but let's just take a quick break.
Okay.
For our listeners to digest and for us to digest. And then let's talk more about this incredible story.
Okay. Now, are all the traitors present? Let's get started, shall we?
From rags to riches.
I'm so sick of this. Working like a dog and being treated worse.
Yorkshire to New York.
We're climbers, you and me.
A life dedicated to revenge.
Let's make this an occasion to remember.
A Woman of Substance on Channel 4 starts tonight at 9.
Hey there, Poodle and Maddie here from Reality Gaze. Do you love reality shows about a bunch of women with matching hair extensions trying to fight against the patriarchy of the Mormon Church?
Who doesn't?
The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives is back on Hulu, and Taylor Frankie Paul has returned with her Mormon minions.
And we are recapping all the drama on Reality Gaze. This show has us fully overstimulated.
It's messy, it's Mormon, it's everything.
Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcast.
There once was a woman who lived in a shoe. A size too snug, but what could she do? But that's not where her story ends. Thanks to a little help from her Experian friends, she got her score into much better shape and relocated to a box-fresh new place with room to grow and a mortgage to suit. Now, she lives in a spacious four-bedroom cowboy boot. Better your Experian credit score to help get mortgage ready. Experian. Better your score. Better your story.
Another part that really struck me was the honey roasted cashews.
So it's so funny you say that because I can't even attribute this to anything. But when you said honey roasted cashews, what a great description. You know, we talk about great descriptions in stories being almost like plot devices. And by just saying honey roasted cashews, you're actually moving the plot forward because that means to me decadence.
Yeah, the height of luxury.
Luxury. Not only cashews, the most expensive.
Right.
I think.
All the nuts.
Yes. All the nuts. How do we both know that, by the way? They're out most expensive of all
the
nuts.
Now with the holidays, honey roasted cashews, God. Like there's little dishes of them. And I look at them now and I can't have one. You know,
no,
I just
fuck
look
you,
at it.
Honey roasted like, cashews.
Exactly. I wasn't going to say that, but yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Just talking about the story, you as a storyteller, and then we can for one more seconds. And then I just want to actually go into talking more about, you know, the story and the reality and the place in your life. Very early on in the story, you're talking about how your father, his occupation and why you were in Wyoming at all was that he was guarding these nuclear missiles. Yeah. And I don't think a lot of people think of Wyoming as that, as you mentioned, Yellowstone and wildlife and what have you. And then you talk about the marriage of your parents and that being detonated.
Yeah. We had lived in Europe for 4 years before that. And so they couldn't split up while we were overseas. So things just simmered and simmered. And then as soon as we got back to Wyoming, the word detonated is really how it happened.
Was your mother, did she believe in God and Jesus?
She did. She was raised Catholic. My parents were both born and raised in the Bronx to Irish Catholic. Yeah, you know, they went through the whole thing. They, in fact, enrolled us in the Catholic school when we got to Cheyenne. So that was a big part of...
I mean, often the Catholic schools are the better schools, right?
Exactly, yeah. It was, and it was small, but I remember one time there was a school picnic, and my dad was throwing a frisbee or something, and he caught his hand on a barbed wire fence wherever the picnic was. We were in a field. You know, it's Wyoming, so it's all barbed wire.
It's all fields and all barbs.
But he got his hand snagged on this fence and was swearing. And I remember that was on the weekend. And then Monday morning in school, one of the nuns said to me, "Your father has a terrible temper." And I just looked at her and I said, "Oh, you think so? Like, you have no fucking idea." It's just always stuck with me that the nun thinking that she was revealing something to
right,
me.
Right, so like let you know of her observation. You're like, yeah. Oh yeah, you think I don't know this? The story, you know, starts basically you're 10 in there when you're talking about, you know, wrestling with your dad, which just breaks my heart. And being home from school, did you feel like anyone was out there looking out for you? Was anyone inquiring? Was anyone?
No, that was the worst thing. When I look back, I didn't quite understand it at the time. I felt it, but I didn't understand it, was that all the adults in my life were fucking with me in a way of like, you know, you think your parents are supposed to take care of you. The bishop is supposed to be the shepherd of the flock. Like,
yeah.
My dad was gone. My mother was a wreck. And there was no adult that I could turn to. And that feeling of not only being alone, but also having to take care of things.
Yeah.
And then having this, you know, nowadays pedophile is in the vernacular of current events and everyone is like, well, he's not technically a pedophile.
Oh my God, this drives me insane.
You believe it? So the actual word is a pederast, someone who is a pubescent abuser. So prepubescent is pedophile. And a pederast is the next, you know, from 12
to 18. I'm so glad.
Yeah, we need that distinction.
Absolutely.
But there was another line that I said in the story where I said he found other outlets after I decided I wanted to go to public school. And I cringed at that because I realized how much pain that simple phrase meant in the world, that there were other boys. And actually, another boy killed himself. So he is literally responsible for the suicides of teen boys, more than one. And when that boy killed himself, the parents, you know, they caught him smoking pot or drinking or, you know, some early
self-medicating.
Teen thing. And the bishop took him on a camping trip. And shortly thereafter, he killed himself. And the bishop took me on those trips. And when the boy killed himself, everyone was trying to figure out why. And the bishop said, you know, well, it's terrible. I tried to help. And that's one of the things that made me come forward was that I said, no, I can tell you why that boy killed himself. And here's what happened. And we ended up being contacted by lawyers from Kansas City and a filmmaker who wanted to make a documentary about the abusive priests, because there was a whole network of abusive priests in Kansas City. And then in the 70s, they were broken up and sent around. And so this idea that, as I tried to say in the story, I definitely hated him. But as I matured and I understood, it was like, he was sent to do that to us by the church. It wasn't an accident that he was in Cheyenne.
Right.
You know, that was a purposeful shunting of him away from a population center to some backwater. But it was a backwater filled with vulnerable kids. And so we ended up making this documentary. And I went to the FBI in both Wyoming and Kansas City because he took me across state lines in the commission of a felony. So that brings it into the jurisdiction of the FBI. And what they said was, well, it's 45 years ago and there are no other witnesses. And I said, yeah, I understand that. And I understand the presumption of innocence and the burden of proof and all of that. And if I were the only person saying this, I would understand why you wouldn't pursue it.
Yeah.
But I can give you the names of 30 other young people who were young men. Now they're either alcoholics, drug addicts, living in their parents' basement. And those people can all tell you exactly the same story. And I didn't know them. I didn't know them until they came forward. And we all have the same story. So at what point does that trigger a broader investigation? And you realize when you have a mayor, when you have a governor, all these people are elected and they're in office for a certain number of years. But a bishop is appointed for decades. So this is a guy who the Catholic mayor and the Catholic chief of police and the Catholic governor tell their sins to, and who married the woman who was the prosecutor in Cheyenne, Wyoming. He performed her marriage. He buried her mother and father. He baptized her kid. And so then I go to the prosecutor and I say, well, what can we do? And she says, well, I have to recuse myself. And I have to find somebody who's not a Catholic who can pursue this. And in the, you know, in the news today, it's very triggering to see these powerful old white guys getting away with this horrific abuse. I mean, abuse to the point that people kill themselves.
Yeah. And know? They're still like, oh, we tried.
Yeah.
The documentary is called Procession. Yeah. It was you and other
five of us.
Five of you.
Four from Kansas City and me from Cheyenne.
What was it like to meet all those other people?
We became really dear friends, and we all still text each other every week to this day.
Every week.
We check in. Yeah, it's really been something. And we are very different, very different. And yet we have that in common. And some of us have had kids, you know, and I was making that documentary when my daughter was the age that I was when I was being abused. And so when I think back at, you know, the shame that I had, why didn't I stick up for myself? Why did it take me so long to put an end to it? And I look at my daughter at that age and I just think that she is not responsible. The shame needs to go where it belongs. And I felt like this documentary did that, although no consequences ever came to those men in their lives from the church or from law enforcement. They were not taken out of the priesthood. They were not excommunicated. I mean, it was just mind-boggling to watch the process fail to achieve anything. And it's, you know, the president and Epstein and all of that.
Yeah.
It's like, it just rings so many bells for me where you just go, oh, this is, the documentary was really the only consequence in his life that we did.
Do you know he was aware of it?
He was. And I had a friend of mine from high school call me, got in touch through Facebook. And he's like, Eddie, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. He was an altar boy with me.
Yeah.
But he had a dad and he had a mom and he had a big brother and he never had any indication. And so there was this bishop doing all these good works, right? Providing for people, going through the community, doing charity and all that. And so his charitable good works were a shield. They weren't coming out of goodness. They were coming out of, I am going to need people to back me up if the shit ever hits the fan. And so my friend's mother said to him, it's just such a shame what they're doing to that good man. You know, these kids, everyone who's coming forward just wants a check.
No.
From the church.
That's
and he
the
said,
response?
You think you
a
could
check?
Call my mom and tell her. And then his mom died before I could call. And he just said to his mom, like, no, I'm telling you, this is true. And she could not wrap her head around it.
What did your mom think?
My mom, it kind of broke my mom in ways that it's still hard. Like when she hears anything on the news about pedophiles, she will call. And I have voicemails that I've saved from her where she'll start to say, I saw on the news, and then she'll just break down in tears and can't finish and just cries for a minute and then hangs up. And I have said to her, you trusted and you needed to trust in those days. And no, but there was not a culture that believed this was even a thing. So my mom was operating from no knowledge. And so, again, the shame does not go on my mother. It doesn't go on me. The shame goes on that guy.
Right.
And any attempt or any effort to divert it and say, well, your mom should have. No. Bishop and the church. Now they have a word for it. It's called grooming, you know.
Yeah.
And he took me to see a James Bond film, and he took me to see Logan's Run. I don't know if you remember that film, where all the women are in these basically 90s,
yeah,
sheer
lingerie,
and 90s. They're prancing around in this futuristic. And the bishop said, we're going to go see this movie, but we aren't going to tell your mom because it's R-rated, but you're going with the bishop, so it's okay.
Oh my God.
And it was the beginning of, we're going to have secrets, you and I. And then have all the honey roasted cashews. We won't tell your mom that, you know, you're having all these snacks and all this candy. And in the moment as a young adolescent, you're thinking, oh, okay. And he hadn't done anything at this point.
Right.
Just having a secret about the movie, and we're having a secret about the candy. And so then there's this like, we're going to have these things that nobody else knows about. And you're getting primed for that. And it's horrific because it's like there's a playbook and he's...
And he knew it.
Yeah.
And he knew it. And do you think anyone else in the church in Cheyenne knew it?
I think the other priests had an inkling.
They did.
Because it was weird. You don't take a 14-year-old boy on a camping trip. And I begged my mom not to go. And she would say, it's the bishop and he really wants you to go. So you have to do it. And I just, you know, now I look, if my daughter begged me not to do something, whatever it was, she wouldn't have to do it.
Yeah. I'd be like, fine.
And with that, the idea that he would, you know, we'd stay in a roadside motel, you know, it was just, you look back and it's like, well, that was the 70s, you know?
Yeah.
That
was, no questions.
There weren't even kids on milk cartons in those days. That's how off the radar all of this was. When I start being withdrawn in school, and I can look, I have my report cards from Catholic school in those days, all the way up until that year, all A's, everything, great grades, even when my dad was gone. But then when that happened, the year after, Eddie's disruptive, Eddie's behavior in class, and it was downhill. And then I just had, for the next 25 years, problems with authority. You know,
how could you not have problems with authority?
You could tell me what to do. My dad was a cop. There could be no worse example than him in terms of protecting the innocent.
Yeah.
You know, and the same with the bishop. And so my life in relation to law enforcement has been no fun until I had to settle down in my late 30s.
Dude, the fact that you even had a turning point,
yeah,
I find extraordinary. I mean, the story also, you know, brings up a lot of ideas that a lot of stories have, just yours is very clear about people looking for father figures that are absent from their life for one reason or another. And then you find potentially a new father figure, and that person also completely crumbles the idea. Did you ever, at that point in your life, were you like, you wouldn't have internalized this, but did you stop looking for father figures? Or do you think you found one in your life?
No, I never did.
Yeah.
And I've realized that my employment history, I've never had a mentor.
I've never had a mentor.
Yeah.
I've never had a mentor.
And you try and you look back and you think,
I want one so badly.
That guy kind of tried to be a mentor and he wasn't, there was no sexual overtone, nothing. It was just that this person is in a position of power or authority over my career and my position, and I'm not going to bond with them. And I'm not going to be vulnerable.
That's, I think, what it is.
Count on them for help.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you remember people talking to you after this particular performance? Or maybe you could have just run out. I don't know.
No, after this performance,
live performance.
People that had, you know, abuse, not necessarily from clergy, you know, from a choir master or a piano teacher or, you know, and there's a certain age, I think, my age and maybe within 10 or 15 years of me, because I think now the culture has evolved to the point that it's much, much harder to be a creepy piano teacher. People are sensitive to the signs. You know, you're still going to have a kid without a dad and a mom is, you know, harried and frantic and
or broken.
And so the victims are still prime, but I think it's much harder for the people in those positions to get away with it.
So you find like you're talking to a very specific demographic.
Yeah. And they come up to me and and they're like, you know, it was great to hear. And I'm so glad you're okay now.
What was your response to that?
You should see the view from in here. But, you know.
Oh, my God. Why does that make me laugh so much? Because people say it to me. Well, that's why I always have a problem when someone, instead of saying, how are you, goes, you good? Yeah. I'm just like, no. You?
Yeah.
But yeah, okay.
It reminds me of a friend of, I think we both have a friend who uses crutches to get around from a condition that he's had his whole adult life. And he was getting into a cab on the Upper East Side and some woman was watching him and she called out, she goes, you're such an inspiration. And he just turned and looked at her. He said, fuck off.
Yeah, that is exactly it deserves.
Yeah. Yeah.
So people come up to you and they're like, I'm glad you're fine now. And you have to take that in however you do.
Yeah.
What made you decide, you know, you tell the story, that was your fourth time on stage. I can imagine just from knowing you, some of the stuff you talked about in earlier stories. What from this performance, doing something so high stakes, vulnerable, intense, made you think, I'm going to keep doing this?
Well, part of it was that what I found out from doing the documentary was lifting the shame. And so this was the first time I had ever told people I didn't know the story. I hadn't told girlfriends in most of my life, but at this point I was married and my wife knew and, you know, but I was ashamed to tell girlfriends that I had been, you know, that I had had this happen as a child. And also, you know, Kevin Allison gives a really safe space. Like the people who come,
they know what they're there for.
Yeah. They know their Pandora's box is going to be opened tonight on the stage.
Yeah.
So that's super helpful. And then that idea that I'm going to tell this because I'm not ashamed. I am a victim, and I am also, I'm where I am in my life, which is that I can get up on stage and talk about this. And then when the documentary came out and it got a phenomenal reception.
It was an Oscar nominated.
It was on the shortlist.
It was on the shortlist. Yeah.
But like Rolling Stone, New Yorker, a lot of really good film critics just spoke about the power of it. And it was super helpful. And all of us, it just gave us a confidence in our life in a way. It's hard to even describe. But just that it removed this burden, a burden of shame, and then put the burden where it belonged, both on the church and on the individuals. I actually wrote a letter to the Pope, Pope Francis.
Yeah.
And I had someone who could get it to him on his desk.
Really?
And he wrote
back
to me.
You know these people? What?
Yeah. He wrote back to me a personal letter. And he said, I am going to do what I can to make sure this is resolved. And then he put it in the hands of the Council of American Bishops. And
you're
the
like, well,
guy from the Council of American Bishops who reached out to me was a canonical lawyer, not someone with any experience in criminal prosecution, not someone who knew how to, you know, forensic investigation of child abuse. They didn't, you would think they would have a panel of people that would talk to me.
Especially at this point in history.
Yeah. And then one of the first questions this guy asked me is, so are you preparing a lawsuit? And I was like, no, I'm not. But that's not what this is about. What this is about is what that man did to me and what you're going to do about it.
Yeah. Protection. He was just protection.
He was like, if we admit that what this guy did happened, there's going to be slam dunk lawsuits against us from dozens and dozens of boys. And, you know, they bankrupted dioceses, I think, in Minnesota, maybe, or Wisconsin and California.
New York now has a case.
Yeah. And so it was like, oh, this is so gross. I can't believe it. And
it's
that's
just
how it happened.
Money.
Billions, you know, it
Millions.
Would be. Yeah. So
what was your response to that?
my response was, here's what you need to think about.
Yeah.
There's dozens of boys that this one guy, and then he's affiliated with four other priests in Kansas City, and you need to, and some of them are dead, but you know, you need to go into all of this. And at the end of the day, they came back and said, we cannot with moral certainty say that what you're accusing him of actually happened. But we're going to restrict his access to youth. So then you go, okay.
What?
So what you have is a retired bishop who can't teach Sunday school. And that's okay with you? If you don't believe me, then I have lied, and this man is an innocent man.
Right.
And he should be free to go about his life with no restrictions whatsoever, because I'm a liar and you don't believe me. And so he should have no consequences from this. But if you do believe me, then you need to follow where that goes. And this man should not remain a priest. And so what you've done is said, we're going to not let him be associated with kids anymore, so we're not at risk of a lawsuit.
That's it.
You know? He died with those restrictions on him, but he was not removed from the priesthood. There's a huge contingent of people who did not believe that we were telling the truth. And he died in that state.
Well, what can I say? I mean, God is dead. That's what I have to say to that.
Or as Nietzsche said, God's only excuse is that he doesn't exist.
Is there anything else you want to chat about?
I'm so grateful to Kevin for bringing us together to do this. And I hope listening to this is, if not amusing for everyone, helpful on some level.
Well, it's deep.
And
it's deep
and entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah.
But thank you for coming out.
Well, you know, you are one of my favorite people on the planet, and I really appreciate it. So thank you, Ed.
Okay. Thanks for going through it with me again.
And that is that. Again, I am so honored that Ed shared his story with us in the first place in 2015, and that Ed and Ophira brought so much honesty and thoughtfulness to this conversation. I have to say that when Risk first started in 2009, even though I was raised very, very, very Catholic, I still didn't grasp what an epidemic child sexual abuse was in the church and throughout society. It's still staggering to me how much of this crime is out there. And the best way to have an understanding of the problem is to hear the personal experiences of the people who lived through it. So I'm thankful we can be a part of helping people share about experiences like Ed did. So you can find Ed at edwardgavigan.com and look for Ophira on Instagram at Ophira E. Remember that we simply cannot continue producing such meaningful programming without the financial support of our listeners. If I can just be completely and totally frank with you, it's really exhausting. It's really psychologically difficult dealing with the anxiety that we on the Risk staff have to deal with every week. If our staff meetings could be more about ideas of what new things we could be bringing to you and less about, oh my God, is this the end? How can we possibly cut our pay even more and continue making this job? The anxiety over how do we keep this going is really, really something. If just 10% of the folks who listen to Risk somewhat regularly pitched in to support us over at Patreon, all of that would just evaporate overnight. You can get an ad-free feed of the podcast. You can get hundreds, over 300 now, bonus stories. There's storytelling lessons on video. There's the check-ins with me. I'm about to do another one. And most importantly, the knowledge that you're a part of this community. You're helping keeping it going. So join at patreon.com/risk or up your donation if you can, if you're already there. Or you can make a one-time donation at paypal.me/riskshow. Another way you can support us is by giving us a 5-star rating and a nice review over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Podchaser. Those also help more than you might know. So thank you so much, everyone. And today's the day. Take a risk.